Hello, welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Well, we've seen the importance of the man Abraham. And in Genesis 25, we're really going to conclude his section of Genesis. We're going to be passing on to Isaac. Isaac's only going to take really one chapter, and then Jacob becomes the next dominant figure. But there was some prophecies about Abraham that needed to be shown that they were fulfilled in his life. This is kind of a summary of his life in many ways. And some exciting things were happening, so I hope you'll turn me to Genesis 25. Now, Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. Rashi and the rabbis say that she is really Hagar. Luther says that the only reason Abraham took this other woman is because he wanted to fulfill the promise of Genesis 17:4 that he'd be the father of many nations. I don't know all of the motive of Abraham. I think when God rejuvenated him to have Isaac with Sarah, and then Sarah died. Now, I'm not sure how Keturah fits in. Was she a concubine before Sarah died or after Sarah died? I don't know. But I don't think we can know the motivation of Abraham. But Keturah is going to have him several sons. Now, her name means the perfumed one, or wrapped in incense smoke. Don't you know she was a foxy lady? Boy, I bet she was. So he took Keturah, Keturah, and she bore him, and we have a list of several different men here. Really, I think that Midian is probably the most significant as far as the ancestors that come out of this, and that tribe is mentioned quite often. They're going to have some real problems with Israel later on. Let me give you a few references. Genesis 36:35, Genesis 37:28, Exodus 3:11, Exodus 18:1, Numbers 25:17, Joshua 13:21, Judges 6:1 and following. And so we have a list here of several sons and their sons. And so it's kind of an extended genealogy. I was noticing the commentator that I love so much, Loophole, has kind of a diagram of this on page 690 of his volume 2. And so that's a good commentary on Genesis. If you've bought that, you might want to look at page 690. It kind of graphs this out for you. And then it contains in the children down there all the way through verse 4. And it mentions the last one, Keturah. Again, these are the sons of Keturah. Now, many of us believe that some of these tribes were later also the Kenites, of which Jethro was a part. And some feel like it's been a Kenite theory in much of Old Testament study for several years now, that say that Moses learned of Yahweh through Jethro, the priest of Midian. I have real problems with that. Though I agree that it came from this area, I still think that somehow maybe these tribes kept their understanding of Yahweh for many, many generations. Now notice it picks up in, now Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines. Now notice it's plural there. This is why I think the rabbis saying that Hagar and Keturah are the same person is just unfortunate. It seems to be two concubines. Now he's going to send them away. We learned earlier that he sent Ishmael away. Matter of fact, quite earlier. And now he's going to send his other children away. We learn from the Nuzi tablets that describe the Hurrian culture that this was very common, particularly in these property right kind of things, where a son would be given his property and sent away, and the one who was going to be the heir, the chief heir, would stay and keep most of the father's property. And that seems exactly what we have here. Verse 7, and these are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. And Abraham breathed his last and died in a ripe old age, an old man and satisfied with life, and he was gathered to his people. I think there's several things there. In Hebrew culture, death was not a tragedy. As long as the person was enabled to live a long life and see his children. We have this same kind of metaphor, a ripe old age, used of Isaac in chapter Genesis 35, 29. Now, when it says a man satisfied with years, I think we need to realize that death was not seen as the ultimate separation. Now, I grant you that the early parts of the Old Testament, Sheol, is not a real pleasant place. It's kind of a pale shadow of conscious existence. But it still is conscious existence. They believed in an afterlife. And through the progressive revelation of the Old Testament and New, the afterlife began to be understood in greater extent. And it became a very joyful thing. I want to give you a few verses that show about this belief in an afterlife and that life is good and death is not serious. And then we'll see Job 42:17, 1 Chronicles 23:1, 29:28, 2 Chronicles 24:15. And this idea about being gathered to your people, did you realize Abraham died away from his people? So many have said, what does this mean? He wasn't buried with his father. He wasn't buried with his kinsmen. So how could this be gathered with his people? Well, it seems to me to be a reference to Sheol in the afterlife, that though he was physically buried away, he was united with his family. And here's some other verses, I think, that speak about the afterlife in these early parts of the Old Testament. Psalm 16:9 through 11, Job 19:25 through 27, Isaiah 26:19, and Daniel 12:2 and 3 have some very positive words about God's care and presence even after death. I think things like Psalms 139 begin to have a great circulation, the fact that God was with man even if man fled to heaven or fled to Sheol. God was there. And this is a new element in Revelation. Then his sons, Isaac and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah. That's interesting because Ishmael had been sent away back in Genesis 21:14. So apparently they were together as Esau and Jacob are going to be at the death of Isaac, Genesis 35:29. It was a very significant thing. Here the two older boys shows they had reconciled, that somehow they were together with their father. And I think it's a beautiful sense that their father died in their presence. Of course, the cave of Machpelah is what he purchased to bury Sarah in back in Genesis 23:17 and 18. And, of course, he's going to be there. It came about, after the death of Abraham, that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived at Beer Ha'arael. Now, this was somewhat, I think, south of Beersheba. We have two previous allusions to that as the place that God met Hagar as she fled the first time, Genesis 16:14, and later in Genesis 24:62. Apparently became a very important site, and Isaac lived there. Now these are the records of the generations of Ishmael. If you're familiar with Genesis, this is that characteristic little phrase used by the author to kind of divide his own book up. Here it's going to be just verses 12 through 18 that describes Ishmael's generation. For as characteristic of this author, he only goes into elaborate detail about those people directly connected to the covenant promise that will issue in the Messiah. Since Ishmael was not directly involved, there's a prophecy about him. He is dealt with kindly. He's present at the burial, and his genealogy is given, but not extensively. Ishmael, Abraham's son, whose Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. And now you have a list of these tribes. I guess one of the most predominant ones here, as Midian was one of the most predominant sons of Keturah, it seems that Kedar here, I think that means black skin. If you're familiar with the Bedouin tents, even of today in modern Israel, you know they're of black, kind of black tents also, and that may be what Kedar is talking about. It's an Arabian tribe. It's mentioned very often in the Old Testament. Isaiah 21:16 and 17, Isaiah 42:11, Jeremiah 2:10, Jeremiah 49:29, Psalms 120 verse 5 are some of the places where Kedar is mentioned. In verse 15, we have Tema. Now, that's a very interesting and very popular oasis in the Arabian desert. Matter of fact, it becomes the center of the worship of the moon goddess Zen, or Sin. and becomes a very important oasis site. And that's one of these centers here for these Arabian tribes. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their camps. Now, this seems to be two different Hebrew references to the place where nomadic people camped, some more permanently and some more only in certain seasons. And that's apparently what villages and camps mean. Notice it says, 12 princes according to their tribe. This seems to be a direct fulfillment of Genesis 17:20, where it mentioned that the angel promised Hagar that he would be the father of 12 princesses. Now, the term prince here is probably synonymous with the modern use of the term sheikh, Bedouin sheikh, Arab sheikh. And I think that's the way this word is used there. This word 12 becomes extremely significant. Here, Ishmael has 12 princes. We hear that Nahor has 12 sons in Genesis 22, 20 through 24. Esau is going to issue in 12 tribes, Genesis 36, 10 through 14. Of course, Jacob is going to have 12 sons. Now, the word 12 came to mean a general number for organization in the Bible. Do I think they're making this up? No. I don't think they're mentioning the children that were born to some of these. And I think they may be listing more of the predominant descendants. But 12 became very significant. It's kind of like the word 40. It's used quite often. And so is 12. Okay, verse 17. And these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, and he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. Again, that characteristic phrase that somehow families are together in the afterlife. Isn't that a beautiful concept? Even today, sometimes I hear people talking about that my loved ones are going to be there when I die. I do believe that we're going to be with our loved ones in heaven. I'm not sure from the biblical evidence if we meet our loved ones at death or on Resurrection Day. I think Hebrew chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 has been pushed much too far to try to prove something about the afterlife that it doesn't. And notice it mentions of him, and he settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes toward Assyria, and he settled in defiance of all his relatives. Now, I think it's significant that we go back to the prophecy about him in Genesis 16:12, which said he's going to be a wild donkey of a man, or a wild horse of a man, which he's going to kind of be an independent cuss and stay out there by himself. And that seems to be true here. It seems that the descendants of Ishmael are to the east and the south of the descendants of Keturah, but both of them are Arabian tribes in the Sinai Desert and the Arabian Desert. Okay? Now, these are the records of the generation of Isaac. And, of course, there's that characteristic phrase again of Moses in the book of Genesis. And Abraham's son, and Abraham became the father of Isaac. Well, the rabbis, they're nervous about any time the Bible repeats something that's obvious. And they say here, when it says Isaac, Abraham's son, why then does it repeat Abraham became the father of Isaac right next to it? Well, they say that there was a vicious rumor that Isaac was really not Abraham's child, but the child of Abimelech. Remember, that's where down the, when they fled the famine and said, "Now you tell them you're my sister," and Abimelech took Sarah, and the whole family was made sick. Remember that earlier in Abraham's life? So Rashi in particular says that Isaac looked just like Abraham in the face, so no one would doubt that he is Abraham's son, and that's what this repetition means. Well, I'm not sure we can go that far, but... And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah. Now, again, 40 years is a round number in the Bible. I'm not sure they had the dating the same way we do. They used a lunar calendar instead of a solar calendar. And I'm not sure they had 30 or so day months and 12 of them in a year. But around this time, 40, when you live 130 plus, then 40 is not that old. It's kind of a time of marrying. That's when others are going to marry, too. That's when Esau is going to marry. The daughter of Bethuel, the Syrian of Paddan Aram. Now, Syrian is kind of the word for Armenian. If you look on a map, Armenia is the area, it's the plains of Aram, and we think around the city of Haran. This particular tribal designation is going to kind of be consolidated in the nation we call Syria, whose capital is Damascus. But in this time, it was more around Haran, the headwaters of the Tigris-Euphrates. the sister of Laban, the Syrian, to be his wife. Now, we're going to learn from chapter 25, verse 26, that at the birth of the twins, he's going to be 60 years old. And that's going to be very important, that he was 40 when he married. He's 60 when the twins were born, Jacob and Esau, because that's going to show he tried to have children for 20 years, just like Abraham tried with no success. Rebekah is going to be barren. Now, notice in verse 21 it says, "And Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren." Now, barrenness was seemed to be a characteristic of these patriarchs' wife. Why is that? I think it's the exact same thing about a little bit later. It says that the elder will serve the younger. That was totally different from the culture. It's God's way of saying, look, guys, I'm going to bring this about in my power. Therefore, your wife may be barren, and you can try all you want to. She's not going to have a child until I do something. Also, you may think the firstborn son is the important one, but I'm going to choose another one because I'm in control of the promised family. I'm in control of the promised seed, and you've got to depend on me. And I think both those reflect that, both the barrenness of these wives and that the younger often is the one the promise comes through. And, of course, Isaac was the younger of Abraham's children because Ishmael was the older. Now, because she was barren, the Lord answered him, and Rebekah his wife conceived. Again, I get tickled with the rabbis. They say that Isaac stood in one corner of the room and Rebekah stood in the other corner of the room and they prayed. But God answered Isaac because Isaac came from a godly family and Rebekah came from a godless family. And they go back and pick up on the fact that Laban was an idolater, and so was his father. And so they say God heard Isaac because he came from a godly family. Well, I agree with them in this sense. I think there is a tremendous blessing that comes from having believing ancestors. Now, if you want to see that in the Bible, you can see it in Exodus chapter 20, where it says, to the third and fourth generation, to those who hate God, the iniquity that falls be passed, but to the thousandth generation of those who love him. And that's confirmed by Deuteronomy 7, verse 9. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? Now, this has been interpreted a million ways because it's a very ambiguous statement. The way that I think probably is the easiest to interpret is like this. Why would God make me pregnant in the answer to prayer to fulfill his promise, and then I have complications with my pregnancy? That's what I really think she's saying. Others have said, this is Rashi, this pregnancy hurts. Why in the world did I ever ask for it? You ladies know what that means, doesn't it? Others say, why do I still live? It means she was despairing of life. And that's what the Syriac translation and the commentators Kyle and Delitzsch say. Well, I think this lady who had not experienced pregnancy before, but obviously she had talked to other women in the family group who were pregnant, and she knew something was wrong. Now, what was happening? Well, apparently there were violent reactions within her womb. The children were like they were fighting each other. Now, she didn't know she had twins at this point. She just knew it wasn't real cute like here, Isaac, feel this little boy. They were really jumping around in there, and she didn't know what was happening. She thought she might be dying. And it was not normal. She knew that. So it says she went to inquire of the Lord. Boy, have commentators gone berserk over this little phrase. Luther says that she went to Shem. Remember one of Noah's sons who was still alive? The rabbis say she went to Melchizedek, who was still alive, because Abraham went to him. And then others have said, no, she went to Abraham. Others say, no, she went to Isaac. Others say, no, she went and prayed at a family altar. That's what Theodoret says. I don't know what she did. Apparently, there was a place, a special place, or a special person, be it Isaac or Abraham or some of these other ancient, famous patriarchal figures that are still alive, because some of them, their lives overlap this history. But she went. I think it's prayer is the best thing. She went to pray and ask God, how can this be? This pregnancy is a fulfillment of your promise. This pregnancy is obviously answer to prayer. And yet, God, it seems that something's wrong with it. Can you help me? God answers her in a very, very specific way. Now, this same promise about seed was given back in 17:19 and 21:12 to Isaac. So he knew he needed to have a child. This seemed to be an obvious divine blessing, and yet here there were complications. And Yahweh said to her, the covenant God, two nations are within your womb, and two people shall be separated from your body. Now the Hebrew here is very intentional. It seemingly means not only separated from your body, but they're going to be separate kinds of individuals. They're going to grow into two separate peoples that are going to kind of separate from each other. And one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Now, this is interesting. It seems to be mentioned in Romans chapter 9, verses 10 through 12. I'm sure Rebecca wondered about this, but it was obvious that it was going to be twins. They were going to be very different, and the normal order and pattern of inheritance rights would not be there. Now, I think certainly Rebecca must have passed this on to Isaac. That's why many of us wonder why Isaac is doing what he's doing in chapter 27 in trying to bless Esau, when obviously by divine revelation it is Jacob. And I think we can explain some of Jacob's acts by obviously his mother told him, now son, you're the one that God's going to bless. So many of Jacob's acts that we kind of interpret as being trickery may have been in great sincerity of him trying to help fulfill God's promise. Now, the problem was trying to help fulfill. That's what Abraham got into and didn't work out. So I'm not saying Jacob didn't act inappropriately, but I'm saying he may have acted from very spiritual motives. And when the days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now, the first came forth red all over, like a hairy garment. They named him Esau. There are two plays here. The word red goes back to the word in Genesis that we get the word Adam from, or the word for ground, created man from the ground, Adamah. So most interpreters of Genesis would say that Adam was made from red clay or red dirt. Now here the word red is going to be picked up on down in verse 30, because Esau is later going to become the nation of Edom. Edom also means red. It's going to be a play on, let me have some of that red soup there. And he came to be Edom. So here's the play. The boy is red. Now, some Jewish scholars have said, see, it means he's going to be a bloody child. Oh, I think that's a bunch of bull. The boy just was real pink, and he had red hair, and he had lots of it. Now, this word hairy, that is a word that seems to be connected with the word Esau. Hairy and Esau are connected. Now, the word Seir, Mount Seir, is also very close to the word hairy. Mount Seir is the name of the geographical location where the sons of Esau will settle that will later be called Edom. So I think you see the two play on the words red and hairy throughout the life of Esau. And afterwards, his brother came forth with his hands holding on to his heel. Now, from Hosea chapter 12, verse 3, that's very unusual that a baby would have a hold of another baby. They took that. They often named children in characteristics that came very early. They named Esau because he was red and hairy. They named Jacob, which means heel grabber. Now, it can mean usurper or planter, surplanter. And he is going to be kind of a trickster person. Trying to help God fulfill this promise. I don't think he just was doing it out of some kind of selfish motive, but he head on to Esau's heels. So they took the name Jacob. Now in Genesis 27:36, Esau is going to pick up on this and say he was a trickster like he always was. Okay. Now they tried to. He was 60 years old when he gave birth to them. They had tried naturally for 20 years. Abraham had tried for 25. And still hadn't had this promise, son of promise. The boys grew up. Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of a field. He's a very different boy. He's an outdoorsman. But Jacob was a peaceful man. This word peaceful is not the normal translation. This is the word usually translated blameless or righteous. You might well see Genesis 6:9 used of Noah and Job 1:1 used of Job. Here, many translations mean he was a homebody, maybe a typical nomad would be better. I don't think he's saying he was a quiet, shy boy, but he was at home, and the other one was gone a lot. So Jacob seemed to be the natural one to take over the family responsibilities. And Isaac loved Esau because of the taste of game. Now, many of us think that Isaac is a more shy person, not anywhere near the dominant personality of Abraham or Jacob. Maybe how, you know, a shy person sometimes in his heart would like to be more outgoing. Maybe Esau was attractive to him. And also here because he liked the taste of wild game. Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, this favoritism is going to really, really cause the pits of a problem. Rebekah seems to be guided by this divine revelation. Isaac, for some reason, seemed to love Esau more and tries to give him the patriarchal blessing when it's obvious that God was not in that. Now, when Jacob had cooked the stew, Esau came in from the field and was famished. He was very hungry. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a..." Now, I have in my New American Standard a swallow of that red stuff there. It's the word gulp. It's kind of a word that means unusual appetite, just kind of taking too big a bites. So it's kind of a strong term here for inappropriate eating habits. And therefore, his name was Edom. They make a play on the red porridge and the word Edom. Jacob said, "First, sell me your birthright." Now, we know from the newsy tablets of the Hurrian society, this was possible and was done. Matter of fact, we know it's done because in Deuteronomy 21, 15 through 17, they have a law against disinheriting the older one. And so I think you see that. This is also related back to Rebekah's revelation back in 23. Esau said, "Behold, I'm about to die, so what good is it in me to have a birthright?" Now, this is a very ambiguous statement in Hebrew. I'm not sure what Esau was saying. Some say he thought he was going to die early. Some say he's about to die of hunger. That seems unrealistic, but fits the context. It shows that Esau was not concerned about his birthright. The fact that he never stayed at home shows that. The fact that he was willing to sell it so easy says that. The fact that he married Canaanite women says that. He just wasn't spiritually minded. Now, in Hebrews 12:16, it's going to say he was a secular man. And I think we see that. So he's going to sell it. And Jacob says, "You swear to me." Jacob realized he may try to come back. So he swore to Jacob, and Jacob fed him. And look at this. Esau ate, rose, and went his way as if nothing, no big deal had happened. He just wasn't concerned about spiritual things. And obviously, Jacob was. And thus, this chapter closes. And thus, Esau despised his birthright. Now, Jacob didn't act appropriately, but it doesn't say Jacob tricked Esau. It puts the blame on Esau. That's what Hebrews 12:16 does. And so I think, though we might question Jacob's manner, I think Jacob's motive was in the right place. I think it was divinely inspired, and I think it's going to work out. I don't think trickery is in the will of God. We have many things recorded in the Bible that aren't always the Lord's will, but I think Esau comes across as the unbelieving one, and Jacob as the one sensitive about spiritual things. I've enjoyed being with you. I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.